This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, Kirby Goidell, the director of the Manship School's research facility, which includes the Public Policy Research Lab and the Media Effects Lab. And Dr. Goidell has written a provocative work, America's Failing Experiment, How We the People Have Become the Problem. Kirby Goidell makes the provocative claim that our elected officials are overly responsive to public opinion, which is often poorly informed, incoherent, and uncertain, resulting in a more polarized political system, rising inequality, and institutional gridlock. We will talk with him about this. And where were you 15 years ago today? It was on this date in 1998 that President William Jefferson Clinton was impeached. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Dr. Kirby Goidell. For 11 years, he's been director of the Manship School's research facility at LSU, which includes the Public Policy Research Lab and the Media Effects Lab, and he has written a provocative book that we will discuss in a moment, but after 11 years, he is staying at the university but leaving this post. That must be a big development in your life.
Sure. It's something I've been wanting to do for some time. Writing the book was really something that led to the decision to step down from being the director there. It's a great position. It's a great facility. They have fantastic leadership there, and Michael Klimek and Srinivas Thalta in the lab will do very well. But I wanted to challenge myself, and I also feel like there comes a time when, in order for organizations to continue to develop and grow, they need new leadership, new energy, new ideas, and I didn't want to stay past the point of effectiveness, and I think I can do a lot of other things like write books, pursue larger grant proposals, and hopefully can continue to contribute to the university in important ways and to the community as a citizen.
Now, when you talk about writing books, that you have done, a book that is literally fresh off the press, America's Failing Experiment, How We the People Have Become the Problem. You make some statements and some assertions in the book that I'm sure some will find a bit controversial.
I hope so. I hope that this book infuriates some people. That's really what I was shooting for. You listen to some of the political talk that goes on, and there's a lot of conversation about, oh, if only we could get rid of our politicians, if only we could get a new group in, if only we could have politicians like we used to have, who were more high-minded, who were smarter, who were better, who were more community. And I don't think that's true at all. I use a quote from Tip O'Neill early in the book where I say that Tip O'Neill, after leaving Congress, they ask him what had changed over his long career, and he said, the people are better and the results are worse. And I think what we have going on are some systematic changes in our political system, which have made it more difficult to govern. And we also have changes that have given the public greater voice and outside interest groups greater voice in terms of policy. And all of that has had some pretty serious consequences.
Where did it start? Where did the problem begin?
Well, I think to some degree the problem of public ignorance and misinformation has always been with us. So if we're going to track back public opinion surveys, we found that the public has often been ill-informed about policy issues. I think there are a couple of things that have happened that have transformed what's going on in the contemporary environment. One is the shift to a digital media environment. So now that we can have more instantaneous feedback, more immediate impact, more immediate response to things, everything is on a higher speed. There's less time to reflect and think about things. Second is a system of money in politics that drives almost everything. And third is a rising economic inequality and a decline in the middle class. And all of that leads to a political system that is more prone to gridlock, a political system that is more oriented toward obstructionism. And so we get less government, less policy out of this political system.
You're sounding somewhat like, Ralph Nader when he ran for president. He talked about how the system is bankrupt and it's time for a change. But as far as the eye can see, it looks like the system we have is in place, and with the new governing rules or lack thereof regarding campaign financing, we may have more of the same rather than less.
Yeah, I think it's easy to diagnose the problem. It's much harder to fix the problem. And so if you're looking at it, it's easy to say there are these issues that are out there that are problematic. I think where maybe I am trying to say something a little bit different, though, than some other folks who have identified sort of system-level problems is I really want to put it back on the people. I mean, we get the government we deserve. If you don't like Barack Obama, it's because we elected him. We still elected him. If you don't like Governor Bobby Jindal, we still elected him. They both won re-election by overwhelming margins. And we the people bear some responsibility for the political system that we have and for what happens in Washington and what happens in D.C. Washington isn't this distant place that has no bearing on our lives. Washington is part of us and who we are as a citizenry.
We're visiting with Dr. Kirby Goidell. For 11 years, he's been at Louisiana State University, professor in the Manship School of Mass Communication and the Department of Political Science. His book is America's Failing Experiment, How We the People Have Become the Problem. Quite often we hear, Dr. Goidell, that politicians are out of touch with the electorate, but you brought up a good point. If they're out of touch, then how do they keep getting elected?
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you look at the House of Representatives, in a bad election year for representatives, the reelection rate is 90% or better. And so what we're really looking at in most midterm election cycles, which we're coming up on, is the House of Representatives will be decided by about 40 to 60 seats, really competitive, though there'll be a lot of money spent in those elections. And in most of the other places throughout the country, individuals are getting reelected. When you look at a Ted Cruz, who is noted for his obstructionism, Ted Cruz is there because the people of Texas elected him, and they'll likely continue to reelect him. And so you have to ask the question, how do these politicians get in this place? How do they stay in that place, and how do they maintain their position? Now, I think we could do some things to change the system fundamentally, but it requires people to really rethink what we're thinking about in terms of democracy, and it especially means rethinking districting and how we create districts and how we represent local interest rather than national interest.
297-5633 is your number for Dr. Robert Kirby Goidell at Louisiana State University. His book is bound to create a firestorm among political junkies, America's Failing Experiment, How We the People Have Become the Problem. Why, as a people, are we so uninformed with all these sources of information that are available to us?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I think that's one of the issues. Well, a couple of things play out here. One is we've always been poorly informed, and so if we look at the voter today versus the voter 20 or 30 years ago, ignorance about politics and disinterest in politics has always been a problem. I think the difference in the contemporary environment is today people have so much more choice in terms of what they're looking at. So what we're seeing in terms of how people are getting information are two things. The political junkies like you and me and other people who may be listening to this program are going out and they're finding a lot more information because information is more available. The average citizen who is less concerned, less interested, is watching Duck Dynasty. And they're not paying as much attention. So the greater information doesn't always lead to a more informed citizenry. And in fact, sometimes greater choice creates problems for people in terms of trying to understand what is the good information versus the bad information.
And quite often, we as humans, we tend to gravitate toward programs and publications that may have like views. So do we exclude quite often opposing point of views that may be worthwhile as far as information before making a decision?
Yeah, and there are two factors that play into that. One is we know that people are selective in terms of the information that they expose themselves to and the information that they pay attention to, the programs that they watch. So conservatives are more likely to watch Fox News. Liberals are more likely to watch MSNBC. None of that's really surprising. I think some of the newer research is even more interesting because it finds that even if you inform someone that their opinion is misinformed, you give them the correct information, a lot of times they don't change their opinion. They gravitate more strongly to the opinion that they had. So finding out when Barack Obama actually produces his birth certificate, what happens is people don't say, well, gosh, maybe I was wrong about this issue. They go, oh, it must be a fraud. There's some grand conspiracy there. And so that ability to do that, what psychologists call this is motivated reasoning, that we start with a conclusion and we look at evidence to lead to the conclusion, as opposed to starting with the evidence and saying, what does all this mean? How do I make sense of the world and what conclusion should I draw?
That's interesting. As most of your book is, if not all, America's Failing Experiment, How We the People Have Become the Problem, from Kirby Goidell, who says that we don't even accept information when we're proved wrong. One of those proved wrong about the birth certificate was Donald Trump, one of the richest, most successful people in the United States. If he can be misled, perhaps intentionally, what about the rest of us?
Yeah, we are very susceptible. We know that individuals are susceptible to something called a confirmation bias, which means that we're looking for information that confirms our existing view. And we know that people think about things not like scientists, not like statisticians, where they're really sort of evaluating evidence to reach conclusion, but instead they have the conclusion and they're trying to find the evidence to support it, which means the more information isn't going to necessarily make people more informed, because what we're doing is we're looking for those pieces of information that already support what we believe. Now, it's a little bit misleading that people are only looking at information that they agree with. They're looking at the other information in many cases too. They're looking at the other side, but they're disregarding it. They're finding reasons to discredit. So if you look at climate change, for example, the people who are the biggest climate change deniers are often the most informed on the science. But they're conservative and they disagree with it from the beginning. But they're paying attention to the issue and they're informed.
297-5633 is your number. Kevin, I need to know who to go to first. Can you give me the information, please? Glenn on Highland. Glenn, good morning. You're on with Dr. Kirby Goidell, author of America's Failing Experiment, How We the People Have Become the Problem.
Thank you, Dr. Goidell. I'm just going to maybe make a reflect on it.
All right, Glenn, you're breaking up on us, so we're going to pause for a few seconds, and hopefully we can get you to a better spot, and we can get your question to Dr. Goidell, who has gotten nice plaudits for his book, which is literally fresh off the press. Ronald Keith Gaddy of the University of Oklahoma says, "Are we the people our founders warned us about?" Kirby Goidell lays out a compelling case for the sources of government failure in the United States. To no small extent, the fault lies with us and the institutional changes we made to our political system. These changes increased democratic controls, but they also decreased accountability and long-range thinking, leading to a crisis management approach to governing. In his recovery plan, Goidell challenges us to think about creatively institutionalizing and constitutionally reforming in order to preserve the republic before it is too late. Let's try Glenn again. Glenn, good morning.
Yeah, sorry about that. Dr. Goidell, if I could give you a just a observation to ask you to reflect. There's a line in a movie I like a lot where the man playing president of the United States says, "America is advanced citizenship." And what that means is it takes a lot of work. So I've thought that our country, as it moves and moves and moves in a different direction, my thought is we are going to become a socialist country or a society dictated by government, because that's just the easy way. It's much easier to live the way the government tells you to than to get out there and inform yourself. And I think that's what's happening. So just ask your reflection on that.
All right. I don't know if Dr. Goidell caught the first part of your statement, Glenn, but Glenn says we're veering to a socialist standpoint in this country as far as our politics.
I would disagree with that. I think that what we're seeing is instead of a socialist approach, what we're seeing, and you can say, okay, what about Obamacare? What about the move towards a more nationalized healthcare program?
Hold that thought, and we're going to take a short break. 297-5633. We shall return in 90 seconds with Dr. Kirby Goidell of LSU. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Dr. Kirby Goidel of LSU, 11 years at the Old War School. And his book is America's Failing Experiment, How We the People Have Become the Problem. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Now, as we went to the break, you were responding to a question from Glenn Duncan about how America, in his view, is perhaps susceptible to socialism because of the current political environment. You said you disagreed.
Yeah, I think I would disagree. I think the question is do we have bigger government? Perhaps. Maybe not as big as it's been at some places in the past. Certainly you can point to Obamacare and national health care reform as an example of larger government. But here's the question that I would ask Glenn and ask you to think about, and that is, if it's big government, who is big government responsive to, and what is the ultimate end of big government? Big government's not just doing things by itself. So go back to 2008 when Barack Obama is first running for president. One of the remarkable things that happened in the campaign finance system there was that he had more money from financial interest than did John McCain. So would a socialist candidate get more money from banking and financial interest in the same time as the Wall Street meltdown than the Republican candidate? That doesn't seem to confirm with what I would imagine socialism would look like. I think what you're seeing really is a Democratic Party that's chasing corporate money, just like the Republican Party. You may have government that's too big, but I don't think socialism is the issue.
HB in Denham Springs. Good morning, HB. You're on the air with Dr. Goidel.
Good morning, Professor. Two quick questions, one on a national level. Has the Electoral College done a great deal to destroy the individual voting power on a national election such as president? And number two, has the lobbyist and special interest destroyed the will of the basic citizen in Louisiana?
Let me start with the Electoral College. That's a great question. I think the concerns about the Electoral College, that's when, at the end of the book, I talk about some of the reforms, and one of the things that I talk about are reforms that I don't think would really have much effect that might make people feel better, and one of them is getting rid of the Electoral College. The Electoral College is really not that big of a concern from where I sit. I think the bigger problem is how we have these very lengthy presidential campaigns that go on forever, that don't make people feel better about the process, that don't engage people in the process in a way that would always be helpful. I think special interests clearly play an important role, but the problem is the more we open up the political system, the more we say let's give people greater involvement. The people who fill in the gap when you open up the process are the special interests. They're the ones who come in. And then finally, I would just throw out there that the definition of special interest often depends on where you sit. My special interest may be your important group that's representing your view in front of Baton Rouge or Washington.
Well, let's talk a bit about the Electoral College. In 2000, we had Al Gore win the popular vote by almost 600,000 votes and lose the election. Louisiana is no longer in play. It was in 1992 and 96 when Bill Clinton won, so we got visits from all the candidates. But since then, it's been pretty much fertile territory for Republicans and will likely continue to be so. So the now 8 electoral votes that Louisiana has, they're taken for granted. So why is the Electoral College not an issue?
I wouldn't say it's not an issue. I think the key is that if you want to fix the things that are really that most people are concerned about, if you're looking at Washington, D.C., and you're saying there's too much partisan gridlock, there's too much people aren't getting along, there's not enough bipartisanship, there's too much partisanship, fixing the Electoral College won't take care of that problem. Fixing the Electoral College will mean that candidates, instead of focusing on targeted states and battleground states, would then focus on battleground metropolitan areas. Campaigns always target their spending to where they think they can have the greatest effect in terms of influencing the outcome, and that wouldn't change at all. I think if you really want to change the presidential process, our presidential primary system makes no sense at all. Ask why Iowa and New Hampshire weigh so importantly in in that process. Ask why we're already campaigning for 2016. We're already talking about 2016 candidates. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. We should be focused on what government is doing today and not on who the next president should be.
But in order to raise the amount of money that is necessary to mount a campaign, 2016 is right around the corner for these candidates.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. And then that's one of the problems. We have so much money in the political system. And when you ask about, you know, is the voice of the people getting obstructed by the special interest? I think that's right, because if you're a candidate and you're running for office, you certainly want to listen to the voice of the people, but you also have to listen to your financial backers. And again, I think the more the process is opened, and there's a paradox here: the more democratic we make it, the more the stronger financial interests can play a role in the political system.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Kevin, which line is Paul on? Paul in Opelousas, good morning to you. You're on with Dr. Goidell.
Good morning, Jim, and Mary. Happy Christmas to you and your guests.
Thank you.
Question. You know, I go through this a lot of time with people about government. You know, government is not from Mars or Venus or anything like that. It's us. It's us. It's people. It's people, you know. Are we our own worst enemies are we microcosms of a special interest, such as what's happening in St. John, you know, the new town that's being proposed? St. George. I'm sorry, St. George. Because they didn't feel that they were getting served, they're going to open up a new town, which is a special interest. They're going to want this, they're going to want that. Are we our own worst enemies in creating our own special interests?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I wanted to lay out there is that when we see things that we don't like in government, we often say, let's have more democracy, let's open up the process, let's create, let's involve the public even more. And I think there's a paradox there. And the paradox is that we say we want more democracy, we create more democratic structures, but what that happens is it allows special interests to come in and fill the gap, because the average citizen is busy. You have jobs, you have kids, you're doing day-to-day things, and so the gap that opens up when we create that space is not necessarily filled by the voice of the citizen. It's often filled by the voice of the special interest, and I think that's one of the problems that I'm trying to identify. And so we the people are there, but the collective sense of what we want out of government isn't there. The St. George example is a great one. Who should decide that case? Should we just leave it to voters? And if so, which voters? The voters of the St. George area? Shouldn't they have a right to determine their own destiny as a community? Or should it be the community of Baton Rouge, which is larger? And what if the pulling out of St. George has a negative consequence on the community of Baton Rouge? Shouldn't people have a say in that? Well, it's a fundamental question about who should have the ability to make the decision. Or alternatively, should we let people who are experts in this area make the decision?
Well, a poll conducted, and we'll talk a bit about this, conducted by the Public Policy Research Lab at LSU, which Dr. Goidell has headed for 11 years, said in the St. George limits, those polled right now, 40% favor it, 35% say no. Outside the city, almost 60%, 59% call it bad. But it's quite possible that it could pass in St. George and be widely opposed parish-wide. And that's the way the rules are. So if they get the necessary, they being those who are supportive of this, get the necessary number of signatures, it may very well become a reality.
Yeah, let me say this about that poll. That was led by my colleague Michael Klimek, who put a lot of effort and energy into leading that. I think it's helpful to provide some information about where the voters are at this particular moment on that important issue. I think that's the question. You know, how should we make the decision? And what I'm arguing in the book is that too much of our political system is narrowly focused on very local interest and not enough on collective interest. And we need to restructure and rethink how we're setting up our political system so that the broader community interest is represented often more than the local interest. So if you're talking about a proposal locally, think about having at-large elections rather than district-specific elections, so that the people who are elected are representing the community overall and not just a portion of that community.
877-217-5757, wherever you may be. Inkstershow@wrkf.org. And Kevin, who is next? It is Mike in South Downs. Mike, good morning. You're on with Dr. Kirby Goidell.
Good morning, Jim. Dr. Kirby, I have a lot of questions about the St. George area and how that impacts the voters in East Baton Rouge Parish. There are just a lot of special interests kind of interwound in all of this, and a lot of them have dispensed a lot of misinformation, and that seems to be driving a lot of the effort as far as breaking this portion of the parish off. I'd just like for you to elaborate on that, if you could, and whether you follow that as an opinion of yours as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure which pieces of misinformation you might be referring to, but I do think that in our current environment, and one of the things that worries me greatly, and this is general, this isn't specific to the St. George issue, that misinformation gets out there and it never dies, and the reason that it never dies is because. Political parties, political interests see that they have an interest in keeping the misinformation alive. And so you still have people who believe that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You still have people believing that the birth certificate is a fraud. So it's harder to combat misinformation in the contemporary political environment. And I think that's one of the problems that I think makes me more worried about democracy today than if I had tried to write this book 20 or 30 years ago, because it's easier to promote misinformation than in the past.
297-5633 is your number for Dr. Kirby Goidell. The book he references is America's Failing Experiment: How We the People Have Become the Problem. Now, are there areas of the country that are more susceptible to political chicanery and manipulation than others?
That's a good question. I think we're all susceptible. I think there are regions of the country that probably have stronger cultural backgrounds of citizen involvement and engagement that make their democratic institutions a little stronger and more immune to some of the problems that we're talking about here. I think that the problem is everywhere and at some level, but it's probably more pronounced in some places than in others.
KC and Central. KC, you're on with Dr. Goidell. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to get his take on political movements such as the Tea Party. I'll listen up here. Thank you.
Yeah, well, let me point out a few things about the Tea Party, and one is that I would draw a parallel really between the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street movement. I think both of them are rooted in a dissatisfaction, a feeling that the system is no longer fair, that the system is not balanced in terms of how it's playing out. I think the Tea Party runs into some issues, and I talk about these in the book. One of them is I think the Tea Party, in many ways, there's an irony here because they like the Constitution. They say, let's go back to the Constitution. But I think if you read Madison, James Madison, very closely in Federalist Number 10, he warns about the powers of faction, and I think the Tea Party is one of those types of factions. And so I think some of their concerns, they reflect very real frustrations, but they may be misplaced in terms of their targets. And so in calling, I think, even for greater democracy and more involvement, something that I think is very valuable, I think that though that their targets, they're missing the target in many cases. And ultimately what they're pushing for is going to make them less happy rather than more happy with government and policy.
You not only dwell on the problems you see as far as our system, but you also offer a recovery plan. How do we start? Is this like a 12-step thing? Where do we begin?
Yeah, I tried to write the recovery plan very much in the language of a 12-step plan, and I think one of the first things is simply admitting that we have a problem, and that the problem is partly rooted in this idea that democracy doesn't always fix what we want. Sometimes what we need is effective leadership, and sometimes we need to empower leaders to act. And on the backside of that, this isn't saying that, you know, I'm not arguing against democracy in all cases. I'm not arguing against voting rights or the ability of all people to have a vote. But what I'm saying is sometimes we need leaders to have the discretion to make decisions, and then we need more collective accountability on the back end. The problem is not enough collective accountability on the back end of things. And again, if we hate our Congress, if the approval rating for Congress is less than 10%, and we're reelecting 90% of our Congress people, that's a problem. That's an institutional failure. And so we need to figure out a way to hold members of Congress responsible for collective outcomes. So how do we do that? Well, maybe we rethink how we design our districts. Instead of having local interest represented, maybe we have people elected from, they could be statewide, at-large districts, or we have proportional representation instead of the single-member representation. So there are ways to go about thinking about this, but they require us really to fundamentally rethink how our political system is structured.
297-5633 is your number for Dr. Kirby Goidell, who after 11 years as head of the Public Policy Research Lab is leaving that post but will remain at LSU, and he will be writing compelling work such as America's Failing Experiment, How We the People Have Become the Problem. Randy and Zachary. Randy, good morning.
It sounds like a point that the founding fathers of the Constitution made absolutely no reference to any type of party. And the biggest problem today is that there's all these factions are not focused on what's good for the country as a whole. Thanks.
Your thoughts?
Sure. Yeah, the founding one of the oversights in the Constitution and the development of the Constitution was the founding fathers really didn't foresee the development of political parties, and certainly not in the way that they developed. There's a fun little irony there, is that even though they didn't see it, and even though that they didn't create it, and even though they warned about the mischiefs of factions, and even though, you know, Washington warns about the baneful effects of political parties as he's leaving, all of the founding fathers who helped write the Constitution were also actively engaged in creating political parties. James Madison, especially the architect, the main writer of the Constitution, was very much engaged in Jefferson in creating really the first broad-based political party. I don't think parties alone are the problem. I think the problem is a political system where we put partisan interest above national interest. And I think if you go back, I think the key turning point, if you're looking for a key moment, is really Newt Gingrich, the 1994 Republican Revolution. Before that time, the minority party in Congress often saw their responsibility as working with the majority to get what they could. Gingrich came in and had a very different approach. His belief was we obstruct, we offer an alternative, and we force so that we can win control of the Congress. He was very successful at that, but it also led to a fundamental change in how political parties operate.
You're listening to The Jim Inkster Show on WRKF. 297-5633 is your number. Back with Dr. Kirby Goidell, America's Failing Experiment, How We the People Have Become the Problem. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Fresh off the press, Kirby Goidell, LSU professor, has a book about politics that is bound to be a focal point of discussion around the country because of the ideas that he conveys regarding a system that he says is fraught with challenges. America's Failing Experiment, How We the People Have Become the Problem, making the claim that the system that we operate under today suffers from too much democracy as opposed to not enough. And you said in 1994 that Newton Leroy Gingrich, when he was Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Bill Clinton was in the middle of his first term as president, that he changed the landscape.
Yeah, and let me note this. Gingrich is one of the most fascinating people, I think, in politics, and there's a lot to admire. And in many ways, he was a visionary. And without him, it's hard to see how Republicans would have taken control of the House of Representatives when they did. So understand, I'm not trying to minimize his contribution, but in the process, what he did was he changed the nature of the Republican Party, and the Republican Party became more ideological. It picked up a lot of Southern seats that were won by conservatives and historically controlled by conservatives. At the same time, the Democratic Party started to shift. So since Gingrich's time, what we've seen is more ideological political parties. The Republican Party is clearly more conservative. The Democratic Party is clearly more liberal. In fact, when you chart this out and look at the ideologies of the party, where there's a bigger gap between them today than any time really in the last 100 years. And Gingrich helps to create that environment. Now, what we have is a political system based on checks and balances and separation of powers that allows a really ideological party to obstruct, and it really makes it difficult for our system to work, because our system is built on the idea that we can bring people together and overcome three branches of government and all sorts of checks and balances on power.
Now, 4 years after Gingrich was ascending to the speakership, he was losing the speaker's job, and the guy who was set to succeed him was Bob Livingston, who on this date 15 years ago announced that he would be resigning from Congress after he cast a vote to impeach President Clinton for lying about an affair. And as it turned out, Mr. Livingston was having several affairs of his own, as was Mr. Gingrich, who also was fanning the flames of impeachment. And for those who have not forgotten, on this date, December 19th, 1998, the U.S. House of Representatives voted for the impeachment of William Jefferson Clinton. Here's how Clinton responded.
I want to say again to the American people how profoundly sorry I am for what I said and did to trigger these events and the great burden they have imposed on the Congress and on the American people. I also am humbled and very grateful for the support and the prayers I have received from millions of Americans over this past year. Now I ask all Americans, and I hope all Americans, here in Washington and throughout our land, will rededicate ourselves to the work of serving our nation and building our future together.
And at that point, Clinton wasn't even sure he was going to hang on as president. It went to the U.S. Senate, and the Senate opted not to vote in a majority. Actually, he needed more than a majority, but there were no majority votes on any of the articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton, showing a divide that still exists today between the Senate and the House.
Yes, yes. And I think also part of the politics of Gingrich was very much, he partly came to power by taking down Jim Wright, who was a Democratic speaker, very powerful speaker. And Gingrich pointed out his mode of operation was to point out that the other side had ethical lapses. Now, the irony of the Jim Wright scandal was Wright was in trouble for a book deal. Gingrich later, of course, had his own book deal, which helped to lead to his own resignation. So hypocrisy on some of these issues is very common. I think maybe the thing for our political system is it really focused on sort of a got you partisan approach to politics, as opposed to a policy-oriented approach and an obstructionist approach, as opposed to an approach that says, how can we work with the other side in order to do what's best for the country?
297-5633, Larry in Park Forest. Hi, Larry. You're on with Dr. Goidell.
Good morning, gentlemen. How you doing? See, my concern is this. What happened to this city, the mayor was recalled by the people, and then the council failed to name someone in the place. To me, that seemed as though you're skipping the buck or something, or you don't even know about your community and whatnot. I would like for those people to go on and resign if they would.
All right, I think he's talking about Port Allen. The governor appointed the successor, a former mayor, by the way. So recalls are hard to pull off. Usually, in order to get recalled from office, you got to really, it's much more difficult, for example, than being impeached.
Mm-hmm. It only took a majority of the House of Representatives to impeach Bill Clinton 15 years ago on this day. But in Louisiana, you got to get a lot of signatures, and then it's got to go to a vote with the people. So, and in this case, it was an overwhelming vote against the mayor. So I don't know that that's really in line with what you're referring to here, but it is democracy in action.
Yeah, and I do think that we need forms of collective accountability. We need forms of accountability so that politicians, where they make mistakes, where they err in terms of representing their constituents, they are held accountable. But I think what we're missing is it's often an individual level responsibility and not the collective responsibility that plays out in many of these cases. Bill Clinton being held responsible for an affair and the perjury really that went along with it and the lying that went along with the affair instead of the focus on the policy. And I think that's part of the problem is let's focus on individual misdeed. Let's not focus on policy, on how we work together and how we solve problems.
In President Reagan's, a listener points out, Reagan's second term, we had Iran-Contra, which some would argue is a more serious offense than Monica Lewinsky, and yet Reagan never had to face a vote of impeachment. It is curious about what people understand sex, or at least they think they do.
Yeah, and Iran-Contra really was a much bigger a scandal than I think it's historically looked at. I think we look back very fondly on Reagan as this likable president who is well regarded on the Republican side. And even liked among Democrats, and often given credit for working across the aisle, but that was a big policy related scandal where Reagan actually went outside of the Congress. Now, what I'm worried about is when you have government that's dysfunctional, and this is something that I point out in the book. You are tempting presidents to go outside of constitutional boundaries, which is what Reagan did in Iran-Contra, and what some people are arguing that President Obama has done on some of the health care issues.
297-5633 is your number. Charles on North Foster. Hello, Charles. You're on the air.
Hello, Jim. Hello to your guests. I have two quick questions. I want to know if the mayor of Port Allen can be impeached, more or less. I mean, because she went to the inauguration for this president and billed the citizens, she paid it back. But we have a governor who supported two failed GOP presidents, and no one in the state seems to ask him for a penny. Why wasn't he recalled? And my other question is, we have George Bush, who went to the Department of Defense after the CIA told him there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He went to the Department of Defense. They found one person that the Germans told were not credible, and we ended up killing over 4,000 Americans and probably tens of thousands of Iraqis.
Let me jump on the Iraq issue, and part of the thing that worries me and part of the issue in terms of the book. So one, arguably there was misinformation at the very beginning of this, where we were told there were weapons of mass destruction when there were not. Whether or not they knew at the very beginning or not, we can leave that up to debate. But if you follow the public opinion on the Iraq war, if you say that our government should follow public opinion, then not only do we go to war in Iraq in the beginning because the public was overwhelmingly supportive, but then we pull out a few months later. That's not good policy. That's not policy that makes sense. I don't really want public opinion deciding our foreign policy in that manner. I'd much rather the foreign policy experts make the decision. Now, does that open you up to them misleading in terms of the rationale and the justification? Absolutely. But there's a trade-off there. And if we followed public opinion on some of these issues, we get policy that's nonsensical.
And on the Mayor of Port Allen front, one of the things she did that caused the ire of voters was she gave herself a pay raise. And of all the things Governor Jindal has done, the one thing he backtracked on, remember, was when he was in favor of a legislative pay raise, and then he was against it because the people were overwhelmingly against that. And that's another issue that people can understand. And because of that, the governor, which he rarely does, he reversed field.
Yes. Yeah, and let me see if I can really infuriate some listeners here, Jim. We get the government we pay for too, and so you know if we're saying that we don't believe that government is worth the money, that the institutions of government is worth the money, then government dwindles and declines in ways that aren't always well thought out and predictable.
Well, I think you make a good point. The governor of Louisiana, I think, makes $130,000 a year. There are hundreds of state employees making more than the governor. Mm-hmm. I think the governor should be the highest paid person in the state, certainly should be making more than the Secretary of Economic Development or the Secretary of Revenue, but that's not the case.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, people will say, let's run the government like a business. Well, how are businesses run today? Well, the CEOs make a lot of money. And they have a lot of flexibility in terms of making decisions. And so when you point that, wow, the businesses are effective while government's not, well, of course they're effective. But now how are businesses held accountable? Well, if Steve Jobs wants to create the iPod or the iPhone, he's got to have a vision. He's got to work on the vision. He's got to put the time on it. And ultimately, he's held accountable by the market. But you don't have the public in all along the way making decisions on what the iPhone is going to look like. There's a vision in place. The accountability comes after, and it comes in a collective accountability in terms of whether he was right or not, and ultimately he's held accountable for that.
Well, as we look ahead to 2015 and the governor's race, a lot of familiar names are lining up to run, people who have been in politics a long time in our state. 2016, a lot of familiar names are lining up to run for president. So this system that we have that you're taking a close inspection of, it doesn't involve a lot of new blood. I was in California the last few days, and front page story in the Los Angeles Times yesterday was a Jerry Brown, 75, and we've talked about it on this show, no surprise. He's looking at running for president in 2016.
Yeah, once you're in the system, I think in a lot of cases you continue to stay in the system. So
we could have Jerry Brown and Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush and all these familiar names. It's kind of interesting that probably the outsider would be Chris Christie, who very much is an insider when it comes right down to it. He just hasn't been around as long as these other people.
Yeah, and I think part of the thing, there are several factors that drive this. One is that politics is more difficult than people often give credit. It's a tough game, and it requires a level of expertise and experience. And these candidates who have been around for a while, they've often developed that experience. And so, generally, if you're looking at a candidate who has political experience and one who doesn't, you vote on the experience, not knowing anything else. So that's one factor. And then another factor is just the fundraising that goes into it. If you want to run for president in 2016, you're right. You need to be raising money now. You need to be thinking about how you're going to position yourself. And I think it's an unfortunate outcome of our system that it's so electorally driven rather than policy driven, but that's the system that we live in.
In your book, America's Failing Experiment, you note that the news media and in journalism schools have contributed to the system we have. How so?
Yeah, I think part of the issue, and I think Thomas Paterson wrote a great book in I think it was 93 or 94 called Out of Order, and I think a lot of the conclusions that he reaches are still in place today. That because of the way that the system works out, the media ultimately ends up being sort of the referee in the political fight in a way that's not helpful either to understanding issues or to understanding the politics at play. And so if you look at these long campaign cycles, for example, for president, candidates have been out on the road for forever talking about issues. Well, the journalists have been there covering it. They've been watching it. When a candidate comes out and wants to talk about healthcare, that's nothing new to the journalists. They're tired of it. They've already heard those lines. Mm-hmm. They've heard them 150 times. But the voters aren't always paying attention unless they're in that audience, unless they're in that local area. And so the journalist is looking for the news story. So what happens is, John McCain falls off a stage. That's a news story. Mm-hmm. Somebody makes a mistake. That's a news story. So what we're focused on is mistakes and errors rather than on the policy statements that candidates are making.
And Ryan notes the verbal gaffes, if they were gaffes, that Phil Robertson made, the Duck Dynasty guy, Will this have an impact on Louisiana politics, considering that Mr. Robertson just got, in Ryan's estimation, Vance McAllister elected to Congress? It'll be curious to see if other officials comment on what Robertson has said, like Bobby Jindal and Mary Landrieu and David Vitter. Do you think that'll happen?
I'd have to think about that one. I think I would probably stay away from it.
I think the prudent thing to do would be to criticize what he said, but whether they'll do that, considering that this guy is wildly popular in some quarters.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I don't know.
Prudent in terms of what he said, maybe not prudent in terms of his political power and positioning. And that goes back again to this democracy question. There seems to be a little question that his endorsement mattered a great deal for McAllister. Is that the system we want?
Well, we had the Duck Dynasty. And we had the Jindal dynasty. And some said we'd rather have one than the other, out of 60 to 40. So it's a question of, some would say, choose your poison. But from all accounts early on, Vance McAllister is a refreshing new face. He's a different kind of guy.
Yeah, and that is true.
Well, thank you, Kirby Goidell. Have a good holiday. And the book that will be in bookstores throughout the area very soon, America's Failing Experiment. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.